It's good that they have something new to sell, though, because there are serious problems with the diet pill market. Some of the junior school parents have got suspicious about how hyperactive their kids have been lately and started tightening up on the prescriptions. Carl and Barry's supply has been cut in half. But it doesn't even matter because the girls aren't buying anyway. Why not? They never stay interested in anything for more than 2 weeks, Barry says. That's the problem with girls as a customer base. He tries ringing a couple of them offering up Coke, but this just seems to freak them out. Now a couple of them buy like 1E a week, and the rest totally ignore Carl and Barry. And Laurie ignores them too. She does not return any of Carl's phone calls. She's never in the places she used to be. Then her friend Janine tells him Laurie left the Halloween hop with some guy.
What?
Carl says. They are in the church car park. Janine still wants to buy pills. It's dark. The church windows are dark. There are no cars around.
This guy, Daniel,
Janine says. She looks up at Carl through eyelashes covered in black shit. Carl searches his head for Daniel, but he cannot find anything. His head pounds like it is splitting in two.
Well, what did you expect?
The girl twists her hair with a bony hand.
You stood her up. You don't do that to a girl like Laurie and just expect her to forgive you.
I was stuck in my house,
Carl mumbles.
I mean, she's got guys queuing up to go out with her,
Janine says. Go out with her? Carl's mind churns like the propeller of a boat caught in weeds, trying to catch all the little pieces of that night and glue them back together. The messages she sent him saying, come and meet me. It was right here in the church car park.
I thought she just wanted to buy pills,
he blurts to Janine. She laughs, a film laugh, with her head back.
You don't know much about girls,
she says. Then she pulls in closer to him, so her tits are just touching his arm, and her voice drops.
I could teach you,
she says, playing with the cord of his hoodie. But Carl is still thinking of what she said about Laurie, and after a second Janine pulls back, stares at him with eyes like a dog you have kicked. Then...
She was with him,
she says, stabbing the words like a knife.
He's been texting her. He sends her poems.
With little shuffling steps, Carl turns away, facing into the dark. The girl dances round in front of him, grabs his hand and cries,
Oh, Carl, why do you even care what Laurie does? She's a child. She doesn't understand what men want.
But Carl doesn't move. He is staring at the concrete ground, where the no-faced boy is kissing Laurie, going to all the places Carl had been, shoving his hands under her shirt, sticking his fingers into her box, flooding her little white fist with jism. Janine steps back. Her hands are still wrapped around his. He can feel her eyes on him, like they're in the distance. In a cooler voice, she says,
Do you want to get her back?
He raises his head. He is so angry. For a second she is Daniel, and his arms pump with the message of grabbing him and tearing him up into little pieces. But then it is gone, and his arms are empty, and Carl is broken. Janine reaches out. She strokes his hair, and then she says,
You really screwed up at the hop, Carl. That's not the only problem either. Her parents found out she'd been lying to them. All the time she was with you, she told them she was with me. Then my mum met her mum at the deli and told her she hadn't been in my house for weeks. She got into major shit. Her daddy likes to know exactly where his little princess is and who she's with at all times. I don't think he'd be too happy about you. Daddies don't like you, do they, Carl?
He follows the movement of her head, wagging at him like a sad dog.
Anyhow, she's basically grounded, so even if she did want to see you, it would be pretty hard.
She smooths back her hair with gentle fingers.
Don't be sad. If you want me to, I can talk to her for you. I could at least tell her how sorry you are. Would you like me to do that, Carl?
Carl nods. She puts her arms around him and gives him a comforting hug.
Oh, Carl,
she sighs, like a teacher with a favourite but always naughty child. Carl has never been that child. He has always been the one they are afraid of. Janine leans back to gaze at him. Then she plants a little cheer-up kiss on his cheek.
I'll talk to her,
she promises.
Everything will be all right.
Then she chucks his chin.
Did you bring my dolly mixtures?
He takes the baggie from his pocket and hands it to her. She unfastens her purse, then says, like they are two people just come out of church standing on the steps talking about the weather.
Laurie says you and her had an arrangement.
Carl shifts from foot to foot without saying anything.
Oh, Carl,
she says again, squeezing herself against him.
Don't worry. I'm going to take care of you.
And bending upwards, she gives him another little kiss, a friendly, mom-type kiss on his cheeks, and then one on his nose, then on his chin, his eyes, his neck, until accidentally one lands on his lips, which are open. And then, accidentally, she does it again. And accidentally, they are accidentally locked tight and wet together. His mouth full of hers, there on the steps in the dark. Just like in his imagination, Laurie's mouth is full of the mouth of the faceless Daniel. But soon Carl will find his face, and then he will be sorry. With posters for the Christmas concert everywhere, audition fever has swept the school. At lunch break, after class, the halls are filled with parps, twangs, thumps of varying degrees of musicality. The rec rooms, clotted with knots of boys, dreaming up routines that range from opera to gangster, to a new form of Wagnerian tropicalia, invented by second year's Catania Diaz, which he has dubbed Apocalypso. The Seabrook Christmas concert may be small potatoes in the grand scheme of things, but as any modern student of fame knows, there is no platform so low that it does not make you look slightly bigger than the next guy. Competition is fierce, and the lowest common denominator does not go unplumbed. Among the rehearsing voices, a surprising number can be heard performing more saccharine versions of already toxically gloopy ballads. Flying Without Wings, I Believe I Can Fly, Wind Beneath My Wings, and others, flying-related and not. Credibility is not the issue for these boys that it might have been for previous generations. A lot of contentious arguments have been resolved in the last decade, a lot of old ideas swept away. It is now universally acknowledged that celebrity is the one goal truly worth pursuing. Magazine covers, marketing deals, artificially whitened smiles, waving from behind barriers at the raving anonymous multitude. This is the zenith of a world now uncluttered by spirituality, and anything you do to get there is considered legitimate. The concert's musical director is Father Constance Connie Lawton, a kindly, epicene man with white hair and a candy pink complexion, whose burning desire to instill a love of classical music in the hearts of his teenage charges, combined with a softly approach to discipline, sees him occupying a regular spot near the top of Dennis's nervous breakdown leaderboard. While he recognizes the populist leanings of the boys, his own tastes are strictly canonical. In particular, he is a fan of the French horn, and has already taken Ruprecht aside for a word in his ear regarding perhaps a performance. No orchestra exists in the school at present, after some past event Father Lawton never talks about. But maybe Ruprecht has some chums, the priest suggests, who might like to accompany him. Dennis laughs long and hard when he hears of this plan.
Pity the poor suckers who get roped into that,
he says.
It's like having the world's biggest kick-me sign stuck to your back.
Hot ticket for this year's concert are the rock group Shadowfax, who, in Wallace Willis and Lewis O'Brien, boast not one but two classically trained guitar wizards. Actual girls, pay actual money to hear the band's immaculate covers of the Eagles and other giants of adult-orientated rock. Even the Automator is a fan, following the band's performance of Toto's Rain in Africa at a benefit for victims of the Ethiopian drought organised by Father Green last summer. Not every aspiring performance is musical, however. Down in a shady corner of the basement, at this very moment, a small crowd is gathered around Trevor Hickey, bent over with his bottom in the air and a lit match in his hand, that, with the solemnity of the magician stepping into the cage of swords, he slowly extends backwards. Diablos, the name given to the igniting of, and ignited, farts. Trevor Hickey is the undisputed master of this arcane and perilous art. The stakes could not be higher. Get the timing even slightly wrong, and there will be consequences far more serious than singed trousers. The word backdraft clamours unspoken at the back of every spectator's mind. Total silence now, as, with an almost imperceptible tremble, entirely artificial.
Just part of the show,
as Trevor puts it. His hand brings the match between his legs, and foom! A sound like the fabric of the universe being ripped in two, counterpointed by its opposite, a collective intake of breath, as from Trevor's bottom proceeds a magnificent plume of flame. Jetting out, it's got to be nearly 3 feet, they tell each other afterwards. A cold and beautiful purple-blue enchantment that for an instant bathes the locker room in unearthly light. No one knows quite what Trevor Hickey's diet is, or his exercise regime. If you ask him about it, he will simply say that he has a gift, and having witnessed it, you would be hard-pressed to argue. Although, why God should have given him this gift in particular is less easy to say. But then, strange talents abound in the 14-year-old confraternity. As well as Trevor Hickey, the Duke of Diablos, you have people like Rory Pins Moran, who on one occasion had 58 pins piercing the epidermis of his left hand. G.P. O'Sullivan, able to simulate the noises of cans opening, mobile phones bleeping, pneumatic doors, etc., at least as well as the guy in Police Academy. Henry Lafayette, who was double-jointed and famously escaped from a box of jockstraps after being locked inside it by Lionel. These boys' abilities are regarded quite as highly by their peers as the more conventional athletic and sporting kinds, as is any claim to physical freakishness, such as waggling ears, Mitchell Gogan, unusually high mucus production, Hector, Hectoplasm O'Looney, notable ugliness, Damien Lawler, and inexplicably slimy, greenish hair, Vince Bailey. Fame in the second year is a surprisingly broad church. Among the 200-plus boys, there is scarcely anyone who does not have some ability or idiosyncrasy or weird body condition for which he is celebrated. As with so many things at this particular point in their lives, though, that situation is changing by the day. School, with its endless emphasis on conformity, careers, the future, may be partly to blame. But the key to the shift in attitudes is, without a doubt, girls. Until recently, the opinion of girls was of little consequence. Now, overnight almost, it is paramount. And girls have quite different, some would go so far as to say deeply conservative, criteria with regard to what constitutes a gift. They do not care how many golf balls you can fit in your mouth. They are unmoved by third nipples. They do not, most of them, consider mastery of Diablos to be a feather in your cap, even when you explain to them how dangerous it is, even when you offer to teach them how to do it themselves, an offer you have never extended to any of your classmates, who would actually pay big money for this expertise, or you could even call it lore. Wait! Come back! As the juggernaut of puberty gathers momentum, quirks and oddities and singularities, turned from badges of honour to liabilities to be concealed. And the same realpolitik that moves boys to forsake long-nurtured dreams of, say, becoming a ninja, for a more concerted attention to the here and now, forces others, who were once worshipped as gods, to reinvent themselves as ordinary Joe Blows. Rory Moran will put away his pins. Vince Bailey finds some product that degreens his hair. In 5 years' time, as they prepare to leave school, how many of the crowd who applaud him now while he takes his bows,
"I thank you, I thank you,"
will remember that Trevor Hickey was once known as the Duke.